hey, Robert, we got Chris on the line. What do you want to ask him?
If they're wanting to get into these kind of deals, do you recommend going small, medium, large deals? How do you recommend doing something like that?
Now you're going to hear different things from different people. Oh, you find deals, you find money, you find deals. And oh, you got to find a market. Now you got to find a property first and you're going to get confused, right? What I think is probably most important, at least in my opinion, is figuring out how you're going to raise equity. If you can raise equity, whether it's your own equity or you have a network of people or even just your friends and family that you think you can raise $300,000 or $400,000 or $500,000 from, I would start with that because it's going to be a critically important piece. And if you can do that to any extent, you're going to automatically have some value to bring to a deal, a broker, a team, or even yourself.
Welcome to the Diary of an Apartment Investor podcast with your host, Brian Briscoe. In this podcast, we bring some of the top professionals in the apartment investing field to discuss various aspects of the apartment investing journey, with the sole purpose of educating listeners to make wise investment decisions. The Diary of an Apartment Investor podcast is sponsored by Four Oaks Capital, bringing you high yield returns through apartment complex investing.
Welcome to the Diary of an Apartment Investor podcast. I'm your host, Brian Briscoe with Four Oaks Capital. Very excited for today's show. It's another one of our Ask the Expert episodes. We have two great people on the line with us. We got Chris Roberts and Robert Wade. And, you know, we got Chris on as our experienced investor. So Chris, you're up to bat first. Welcome to the show.
Awesome. Thanks, Brian. I appreciate it. Thank you so much for all the value bombs you drop out there in the real estate world. I definitely remember when I first got started in this space, you were about a year ahead of me and we really vibed and you helped me a lot. So I appreciate that, man. Thanks for all the
vibes. Yeah, I remember sitting down at a hotel in Reston, Virginia for like 2 hours with you, you know, waiting for we were both there early, both waiting for the conference to begin. And it was a lot of fun. It's been fun following you since. And you guys have done some really, really big things, closed on some big deals. So excited to finally get you on the show. Thanks for coming.
Of course. Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Yeah. So why don't you tell everybody a little bit about yourself, you know, where you come from and, you know, what got you into real estate investing?
Absolutely. What I find most interesting about this space is that you can get in it literally a million different ways. And I find that a lot of people start fixing, flipping or things of that sort. I was similar in that I bought a few pieces of land, I don't know, 15 years ago or so, traded them, made a couple $1,000s and thought this is great, got off the path. Fast forward, I don't know, seven, eight years ago or so, and bought my first foreclosed property and paid $99,000 for it. And I remember when I first bought that property, people were telling me, oh, you don't want to buy in this neighborhood. Don't go there. It's not a good market. And I said, well, the data is telling me different and I'm following the data. And I learned that very early on. So I bought some houses, flipped, fixed, rented, all that stuff, got into duplexes and then scaled from there into multifamily. And this was after building a wonderful sales career and investing in other companies and being partners in other businesses as well. So I have a track record of business, but real estate started kind of traditionally the way a lot of people do, which is those fix and flips.
Yeah. Now, did you do all the fix and flips in your backyard area or what was your business model for that?
You know, again, it's I guess against the grain or against the norms, but I wasn't too concerned about being really local. My first property was an hour and a half away, and I would go to work during the day and I would load my trailer with tools. I would take it with me. And after I'd head to the property, work on it. 6 weeks later, I'd put it up for rent, rinse and repeat. Right. But I wasn't really close, an hour and a half or so.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's enough to scare a lot of people away. You know, we had a property that we put up for sale and it was 45 minutes away. And I was just like, oh man, I got to drive that far. But, you know, and end up doing similar to what you did. It wasn't exactly a fix and a flip. It was, we've had renters for the last 10 years and now we got to, you know, make it sell worthy. But, all within, you know, a short drive from your house for the most part, you know, single family, fix and flips, and then a little larger. What prompted the move into multifamily?
Yeah. So I was listening to podcasts one day and I came across this individual, Michael Blanc, and heard him. Yep. Heard him, heard others, but for whatever reason, I resonated with what he was saying. And then I jumped on a plane and went to one of his 3-day events and the rest
is
history.
Where we met. Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. What's interesting is that sort of catalyst to say, and I'd read this long ago, but it was about scaling. And it was saying, you know, when you buy one house or you buy a skyscraper, there's really no difference. It's just a little bigger down payment. And it really got me thinking after, I know it sounds crazy, right?
Yeah, right.
It really got me thinking after he dove into the details. I thought, wow, well, I believe I'm intelligent enough to do this, but I need some guidance and some bumpers, if you will, to make sure I don't fall off the rails. And then the rest is history. But yeah, just need to scale to grow and bring others along with you. That's what it boils down
to. You know, and I agree with that. I mean, the process is very similar. You know, there's a lot of similarities between buying a single family house versus, you know, a skyscraper. I haven't bought a skyscraper yet, but, you know, I'm making that leap. But, you know, the largest thing we have is just under 200 units. And there's a lot of similarities. I'll say there's not that big of a difference between closing on a 20 unit property, because we've done that, and closing on a 200 unit property. You know, so you add a zero onto everything. You know, add a zero onto the loan amount, add a zero onto the down payment, so to speak, and a zero onto the purchase price, and everything else is very, very similar. So, from a lot of ways, it makes sense to scale. So,
I think it's what's interesting. Most interesting is, unless you have a lot of vision, a lot of guts or courage or good team, or, I mean, you have to have something that drives you, could be a why, a vision, a purpose, whatever. But it's funny, once you actually start knocking out 100 plus unit complexes, you realize, oh, this is just bigger systems and bigger processes, right? Mm-hmm. A little bit more courage, whatever it is, a little more travel time. But the systems, or the structure itself is not much different than a single family, aside from legal fees and things like that.
Well, since you brought the why up, you know, I'll just ask you right now, and we'll get that part through. But what is your why?
Yeah, well, my why probably was deeply rooted in my upbringing. I was on my own at a very young age, struggled, actually stood in food lines as a kid, and just really had a lot of strife growing up. And I think that the work ethic was ingrained in me very early, because, you know, we didn't have money, and it was, you have to go build it. And as I started building a little bit of, I guess, wealth and success in business, you know, the corporate America sort of had a few scares in corporate America, where it didn't matter how hard you worked, how many awards you won, whatever you did, you could be on the chopping block tomorrow. And I realized that the only way that I'm going to create that security in my life is to build it myself. And the only way to do that is through passive cash flow. And that's what led me on to scaling, was I need something that makes me money when I sleep. And so the why really was deeply rooted at a young age, but I also have other whys. I mean, we're partners with Feeding America. We fed 380,000 people year to date. We're passionate about that. We have a goal of feeding 1 million people, and I love teaching people. And and that's part of my why as well. So it's kind of a three-pronged attack, but that's my why.
Yeah, I'll tell you, my why has definitely, you know, evolved over the years. You know, I've had, you know, whys that have driven me, and, you know, whys that have been kind of ancillary. But I think you're right. You know, if you have that why down there, it can drive you to do a lot, you know, and get you out of bed in the morning, and, you know, get you, you know, on the phone with brokers and potential investors and all of that. So, so cool. Let's talk about some of the deals you guys have done. You know, pick one that you'd like to talk about, and let's go into some details.
Sure, absolutely. I love talking real estate, digging into the details, and what I love most of all is talking about the stuff most people just don't talk about. You know, you go to seminars, and you know, it's great to get motivated, inspired, fired up, right? It's awesome.
Talk about rainbows and unicorns. Oh, yes, you know. Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. You can conquer the world when you leave one of those seminars, right? But it's interesting. Once you start getting your hands dirty, you realize that, you know, there are actually shootings, there are fires, there's domestic violence, there's all kinds of challenges, there's financial issues.
All of the above. I mean, right. Yeah, we've had shootings, we've had fires. Yeah, all of the above.
Yeah. So, if you're building, you don't want this to happen, but if your building hasn't had a fire, you probably don't have a building. I mean, that's, and people don't want to hear that, but you know, that's just kind of the reality of the space we're in, right? So, it's funny today. So we've been in the multifamily space for about 3 years now, a little less than, and we went from zero multifamily, aside from duplexes, single families and such, up to about 950 doors by the end of the year, right? Yeah. Across 8 different buildings, I think 5 or 6 different acquisitions, and and obviously continuing to scale and all of that. And within that is mostly Class C. We go for Class C, B minus type properties, value add, and we target the returns very similar to what you might see out there. But we like the hairy stuff. I mean, the main reason for that is, you know, there are a lot of folks out there that go after the Class A, which is awesome, a little more stable and probably consistent cash flow day one. But I found when we first started, and I'll give you one perfect example of this on a specific deal. But what I found was, if you had a little more, I guess, meat on the bone or a little hairier deal, There was more upside potential, of course, scarier, riskier, and all of that. Riskier mm-hmm. in the sense that you might have crime, you might have higher insurance, you might have higher vacancy or bad debt. But if you were very conservative in your underwriting and followed your data, which is what I started with in this conversation earlier, mm-hmm. You likely won't go wrong. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are very fearful to take that chance, right? Because the Class C properties are not for the faint at heart. They can be very challenging. You're mm-hmm. dealing with sometimes challenged income individuals and so on and so forth. So by doing that, it has boded well for us. I'll give you one particular example, and I won't share the exact numbers just because mm-hmm. of rules and regulations and SEC and whatnot. But I would tell you this: we were very conservative in our underwriting, and we paid. I'll give you some approximate numbers. We paid in the mid threes for this property, $3.5 million or so. It's estimated not even 18 months later that we could get somewhere between $10 and $11 million for this property.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, why is that? Well, the specifics are mom and pop owner, right? Mm-hmm. Vintage 1980s, original owner. Son coming in to help, distressed, wanted to get out of it. COVID hits, right?
Yeah.
And a myriad of other challenges. The rents are extremely low. They're 50% below market rent, right? Mm-hmm. And a bunch of other data points that would work well for you if you were good at executing your plan, had good construction crews on board, and we're not fearful of the what ifs, because this was a really hairy deal in a rough neighborhood. We are looking to exit that property, outperforming our pro forma after just 18 months of, I think our numbers are just over, I think it's like 40% NOI or something like that, above pro forma. I mean, the numbers they're so staggering, you wouldn't even believe it. Now that's not because we're miracle workers, right? That's because we're a little fortunate with the growth in the market, right? We're fortunate with supply and demand issues. We were fortunate with the right buy with a mom and pop shop owner with very low rent. And we're fortunate that we were able to execute lowering our expenses while increasing the NOI 18 months ahead of pro forma, right? So there's a few things we did, but there's also the market. And you don't want to rely on just the market, right? And leaving it to chance. So just food for thought. But this particular deal was very challenging. It was all manual. All of the documentation was manual. There was no electronic data. Had to rebuild T12s and rent rolls and all that stuff with them and have them certify them basically for the banks. But we're sitting in an extremely strong position now. And I could tell you some other stories about deals, but that's an example of buying a kind of hairy, challenging deal and it paying off because we had really good team and good execution.
Yeah. You know, and there's a lot of work involved, obviously. You know, you take something, you reposition it, you do a lot of stuff. And you know, what you said reminded me, you know, we're looking at you're helping somebody get a deal across the finish line right now. And this particular property literally has the rent listed on the sign, right? You know, this amount per month. And I went through to Google Maps and that sign was there in 2018. You know, and so you look down the rent roll and every single unit is at that rent spot, you know, and you're kind of scratching your head. And that's an opportunity, you know, that each one of the units needs a little bit of work and we're going to put a lot of money into it. But at the same time, you know, if you're looking at creating value for your investors, you can find something like that. And it's like, it's about $400 behind market rents because that's where rents have come. But yeah, I hear exactly what you're saying. I mean, you know, you get some of that growth from your forced appreciation, some of that market growth, if you're fortunate enough for it, and you can create big wins.
Big time. Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of ways to win in this space, but you got to put in an awful lot of work. You got to have thick skin, be tough.
Yeah. So right now you're sitting right around 900 units. You know, what's next for you guys?
Yeah, we're highly focused on building out our systems and getting our efficiencies built out. We've been really good at building automations and back end, expanding our team slightly, but we're highly focused now on really refining that process just through operational efficiencies and just bringing on new software and things of that sort. Obviously we're growing. We don't have door unit count goals. I feel like there's too much pressure there and that you can make mistakes and force deals. We're growing regardless. We have deal flow. It's just a matter of actually building up the systems and teams. So that's kind of what's next for us is just continuing to refine those processes.
All right. Now your portfolio, are you guys in one area of the nation or are you guys spread across the world?
Yeah, we have kind of a one-off in Virginia that we actually just sold. It should close in January. We have several properties in Georgia, and we just closed on 3 properties in Texas. So we're primarily in Georgia and Texas. Those are kind of primarily our markets, and a few key markets in each one of those states. And we have boots on the ground in each state. We have boots on the ground.
Okay. Now you say you follow the data. What data points made you look in Georgia and Texas in particular?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because data doesn't always tell the story. You really need to get on the ground and actually shop. You know, anyone will tell you that. You go and you look at comps or CoStar or even 2 different CoStar reports, and they're different, right? So what drives us generally is at least some degree of migration of people moving to the state. We like a little bit of income growth, population growth, things of that sort. But we also like to look at the assets compared to the acquisitions compared to assets in the marketplace, you know, because, man, it can be really segregated. It could be a 4-block radius when your city data reports or Yardi or whoever is actually reporting on a county or a state and they're not reporting on that actual 4 or 5-block radius. An example is we're acquiring a property close to a hospital and college, and the average household income is 40% higher. And it's only within about a 5 or 6-block radius, but there's demand there. You wouldn't know it unless you were actually shopping those complexes specifically, right?
Yeah.
So we look at some of those variables in the beginning.
All right. Cool. Well, we're going to shift gears right now and introduce Robert Wade to everybody. So Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Appreciate being here.
Yeah. So do us a favor and tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us, where you're from, what you've been doing, and what got you into real estate.
Okay. So I live in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, like 2 hours straight south of St. Louis, southeast Missouri area. I've been here my whole life, other than just shoot a few little short stints of being out, like Marine Corps and stuff like that. So, after I got back, got out of that, I went back to college, became a nurse, started working in the health field. And I ended up getting out of nursing, going into pharmaceutical sales, did that for 20 years. As I was telling Chris a while ago, just during our little introduction, I was telling him, I said, you know, being in a sales field, especially in the pharmaceuticals, there's a very high turnover rate in that industry. I saw early on there that I needed to be doing something because I didn't expect to retire from that field. So I actually started getting into real estate. My mom and dad had done real estate in their lifetime, so I kind of knew something about it. Didn't know a lot about it, but I decided to start getting into it. So my first deal was a spec house that we ended up building in a new subdivision. And we did that we bought that house on 5, and the market ended up crashing while we were doing that. And then we ended up hanging on that house for 5 years before we got rid of it.
Ouch. Yeah.
Yeah. So basically my first 2 ventures into real estate weren't good. And we actually got out of it for a little bit and then came back to it. Because the whole time I'm sitting here thinking about this industry, I'm sitting here going, the only way I'm going to be able to get accomplished where if I want to have a better lifestyle, freedom to choose and do what I want to, when I want to, and be able to take care of my family, so I've got to have money. And what's a good way to do that? Real estate was a good way to do this. So I got back into it, started buying rental houses, doing single family. We actually got up to where we had, as far as if you just counted a door as money value, we had around 18 or 19 doors. One of them, we ended up buying a 6-unit apartment building that we still own. But it was kind of going back to what Chris was saying. Ended up buying it almost like a house. I just looked at it from a house standpoint, and that's what I went at this. Gotten to a point where I want to scale up and get bigger and do more things. And I've got things personally that I want to do, but the only way I'm going to be able to do that is if I can generate more income and have money to be able to do this.
Yeah, absolutely.
It has something kind of to do with military folks. I want to get back to the military community. But I need money to do that. So the only way I'm going to be able to do it is get back into multifamily where I've got time to focus on that and monetary ability to be able to do it also.
Yeah. And, you know, agree wholeheartedly. I mean, we do a lot of charity work. And I think that a lot of the military based charities are, you know, near and dear to my heart too. You know, a lot of good to be done there as well. So, You know, Robert, let me ask you a question. You know, I think you kind of alluded to this, but what is your big burning why?
Well, that just personally, but mm-hmm. I'm going to kind of make this as short as possible. My mom and mm-hmm. dad were 98, 94 years old. Mm-hmm. Dad would have been, let's see, this is the 19th. Dad would have been 100 years old Tuesday. Mm-hmm. He passed away 2 years ago, December 8th. Mom passed away 59 days later. Mm-hmm. And then 3 days later, my daughter and son-in-law gave me two grandkids, mm-hmm. a set of twins that have absolutely just taken over everything. They are just absolute dolls. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to make sure that I've got something in place that they can come into if they want to do this. It's there. I could teach them as they're growing up, mm-hmm. but I want to make sure that they are taken care of, and my daughter and son-in-law mm-hmm. is whenever I get older and I'm not here, but with having parents that were 98 and 94, the gene factor's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I hope I could live to, you know, just a number that begins with 9 to start with. You know? I'd be happy with an 8, you know, to be honest with yeah. you know.
That's what I've always thought about. My dad always said, he said, I never expected to make it this far.
Yeah. My grandfathers both died when they were in their 70s, and my grandmothers both died in their 90s, you know, so you know, hopefully I side with the grandmas, not the grandpas, yeah. But yeah, I think that's something that a lot of people, you know, have in common. You know, it's about taking care of, you know, those who come after us, taking care of our kids, taking care of our, you know, hopefully, you know, not too soon to be grandkids, but I hope I do eventually have grandkids, but very, very common there. And I very much appreciate you for sharing that. You know, that said, we'll move on to the ask the expert portion here. And, you know, the part where I get to say, you know, hey, Robert, we got Chris on the line. What do you want to ask him?
Appreciate it. I appreciate you being here, Chris. I appreciate you taking the time to hear me out here and hear my questions and kind of help me out here. So, like I said, with my mom and dad passed, the last couple of years has kind of put a damper on my things. But having those grandkids has also gotten my why back stronger and wanting to get me moving again and doing this. So from a multifamily standpoint, somebody that maybe has a little bit of experience or maybe none, if they're wanting to get into these kind of deals, you recommend going small, medium, large deals, trying to find a network of folks and going large first off. I mean, how do you recommend doing something like that?
Well, Robert, thank you for the question. I appreciate it. Appreciate being here with you. I would say this, the one thing I learned fairly quickly was it wasn't really a matter of having guts or even so much having a team. It was a matter of figuring out how do I scale and what's the most important thing to scale? Because I had guts, I was building a team, I knew people, and a lot of that kept coming back to equity. Okay, now you're going to hear different things from different people. You find deals, you find money, you find money, you find deals, and you got to find a market. Now you got to find a property first, and you're going to get confused, right? What I think is probably most important, at least in my opinion, is figuring out how you're going to raise equity. If you can raise equity, whether it's your own equity or you have a network of people, or even just your friends and family that you think you can raise $300,000 or $400,000 or $500,000 from, I would start with that because it's going to be a critically important piece. And if you can do that to any extent, you're going to automatically have some value to bring to a deal, a broker, a team, or even yourself. But if you can't raise and you don't have a team and you don't have deal flow and you're nowhere. But if you can raise some equity, you are coming from a strength position, if that makes sense. Now, right. A lot of people, they don't pay attention to that in the beginning. They mm-hmm. think, I need a team. I need a system. I need a website. I need XYZ. And as they get rolling, they realize that a lot of the other people they're connecting with are not equity partners either. And so then no one has money. Yeah. Well, if you don't have experience and already have broker relationships, none of you have a value proposition that you can share with anyone that would draw the right type of equity to you. So what I'm saying is if you have the capability of raising a little money, okay, first in any way, shape or form, especially if you partner with one or two people that can even raise just a little, Now you're coming from a strength position. You can start shopping brokers. You can start shopping markets. You can look for people like, I'm just giving you an example, but say Brian's team or my team or somebody where you're saying, hey, we got a deal through a broker relationship. We've got 700,000 sitting here amongst our group. We need some help getting in a deal. Do you have some other people in your network like Brian and the Titans, mm-hmm. right? Awesome. Hey, we know somebody just like you, but they're actually on the ground in Missouri and they're really good at underwriting and they found a deal, right? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden we're pairing you up. But if you don't have a value proposition, and that value proposition usually has to have some equity, even if it's a couple hundred thousand, you are almost nowhere in this business. That's my opinion, but it's really important because I found that to be the weakest link among everyone that I deal with, 100%.
Yeah, and I agree on a lot. I mean, we talked earlier about the difference between a 20 and a 200 was just the size of the down payment. You know, it's just adding a zero to the end. You know, maybe we were a little more flippant about that, but you know, really it's how much money can you bring to the table? That's what's really going to determine deal size, you know? So I don't think there's a magic number for somebody. You know, I just got off a phone call with somebody who asked me, hey, you know, do you think I should go after a 20 unit or 100 unit? And really it comes down to, you know, how much money can you bring to the table, you know, whether your own money or friends' money, you know, so 100% on board with what Chris said. I mean, you have to be able to bring money to the table, and how much money you can bring to the table is going to determine what size deal you get into. I do think there's a lot of benefits to going bigger. But at the same time, you know, going bigger is going to require you to have, you know, more systems and have to be able to handle and take care of more and more money. So I don't think there's a right or wrong answer to it. You know, I know a lot of people who've done very well starting around 20 units, and a lot of people like Chris who've done very well. Chris, I don't think you've closed on anything less than 100, have you?
No.
Yeah. So both work is the bottom line, but where you start is going to depend on how much money you can bring to the table.
Well, I guess that kind of goes into kind of like my next question, because we all talk about systems that are being used and how we go about doing that. So for those folks that haven't been around this, I mean, would you mind explaining the system from a bare bones type fact of what it is you're looking for in a system? I mean, how do you put this stuff together? How do you combine everything so that it flows like it needs mm-hmm. to? I mean, what are you looking for?
100%. And Robert, thank you for that question. That's a very good question, because it's very complicated. Once you get into the space, you realize there's a lot that you don't know, and it can be expensive, right? To build out everything the right way. I'll tell you basically how I did it. Okay. When I started, I went to some meetups. I started getting very active in these Slack channels, right? I started getting active on websites, Facebook, and so on and so forth, meeting people, meeting future partners, potentially. What I started with was a website, cheap, $30 a month, right? Built a website to have some sort of thought leadership. And then I invested in a software, a CRM software, which again was only $50 a month. This is not a lot of money, $50, $80, $100 a month. Okay. Those two things, if you just had a basic website, and even if you don't have a website, if you have some sort of platform, it could be Facebook or something, but you have to have some sort of platform to start putting your thoughts together and building a following or a base of some sort. And a CRM, anything, could be ActiveCampaign, could be MailChimp, just something to measure all the people you're talking to and how they're coming in and going out, and investors and things like that. If you have those two things, that's a very good basic foundation to start raising capital and talking to people and reaching out to potential team members. So from there, you're starting to build your base of investors, right? And it could be just 4, 5, or 6 people. My first raise was only 5 people, right? Now we have hundreds of investors just 3 years later. Right? So it doesn't take long once you start rolling. If you started with those two things, you would be well on your way. And then you're going to build more systems from there, right? You're going to have investor relations software. You're going to have team software like Monday Morning where you can all communicate, but you don't need to invest a fortune in that stuff when you first start. That's where you would start. Then you need to find your next step, in my opinion, is to find maybe one other individual. It could be your significant other. It could be someone that you met at a meetup. It could be someone in a think tank or someone with boots on the ground in a market you want to be in. But you need somebody else. And I'm sure Brian can attest to this because he and I have built similar teams out. You're going to need more people to be very successful in this space. It's very difficult. And I'm going to give you one I'm going to give you some support behind this comment. I was speaking to a broker, a really relevant large broker the other day, and we were talking about our team. And he said, you know, what's interesting, Chris, he said, the reason you stand out and you're stronger than a lot of teams, which Brian, again, can attest to this, if he hasn't heard this, is you are a group. You are a unified group that has a lot of experience from different fields, but you're all unified. You're not one single individual trying to tackle $15, $20 million deals. That doesn't look as good to lenders or brokers or anyone else, because it's really hard to tackle these deals by yourself, right? So if you build a little LLC out with one, two, or three people on it, or even just one other person, right, that comes from maybe an investor background, they can raise capital or systems background or whatever, it'll help build your position as a thought leader and make you stronger when people are looking from the outside in. I know that's kind of a long-winded answer, but Brian, do you think?
That makes sense.
Yeah. You know, Robert, I'm going to lean in on our shared background. You know, I think the Marine Corps is a classic example of building systems. You know, everybody who goes through recruit training is taught to do things the exact same way. You know, and you look at, you know, private first class in the Marine Corps, they all lace their boots the exact same way. You know, they all walk the exact same way. They put their trousers on the exact same way. You know, and it's that system that they're being taught to work in. You know, you fill your rifle magazines the same way, you tap rack bang the same way. You know, it's all the exact same thing you do. And when I look at systems, that's what I go back to is, you know, I don't want to have to think about what I'm doing when I'm talking with an investor. All right. I've already thought about that, you know, 6 months ago, wrote down my system, and now all I have to do is hit the repeat button. You know, I mean, obviously every conversation is different, but that's the idea of the systems is, you know, you just find something that works, document it, and then repeat it, and you keep on repeating it. And that's really what the idea of systems is. Chris gave you some great examples of how that works, you know, inside the real estate business, you know, with the CRM, with the, you know, your investor list and everything else. But basically it's back to boot camp. You know, you lace your boots left over right. You do it that way every time. So
yeah, Robert, one last, and that's a great point, Brian. A good analogy. I come from reserve police officer position, so I can somewhat relate to the systems and processes. Two is one and one is none, and so on and so forth, right? One thing, Robert, I want you to take away from that as well, and I'll just close the question with this. Remember that the people that know, like, and trust you, that term is used a lot in our space, they're gonna follow you. You know, if you've been successful in the past or you have a decent reputation with your friends and family and you have a good opportunity, because that's what these are, they're going to want to be part of that opportunity. I found that, you know, people get excited about that. So if you can find a way to just build a little bit of knowledge base on this, in this space, you will find that a handful of people will just come along with you because they know, like, and trust you. And as long as you do them right, you're going to make them some money and then you're going to move on and grow from there. So just be confident on that level. Don't feel like you have to know everything to bring in $200,000 or $300,000. You don't actually. It's not that difficult to bring $200,000 or $300,000 to the table.
Well, this is just kind of like putting together a team around you of people that have the knowledge to do the other stuff, and you just supervise. I guess
it's a little more complicated, and maybe we go offline a little bit more on that. But yeah, you know, everyone has their specialty.
All right. So. You were talking about, you like to kind of like focus in classy areas, apartments and things like that. So how did you go about, especially with you coming from Washington State, how did you go about finding or getting information on Georgia and Texas and the demographics of where you're looking at apartments?
Thank you so much for that question. Yeah. I love this question. I'm asked this all the time because it's a long ways, right? It's a long ways to fly. So,
I'm just going back to, I know people around me, long distance ownership is not something right now that they're interested in.
I'm gonna make this really simple for you, Robert. There's a term I use constantly called paradigm, and it's a reflection of the way we live based on our experiences. That's what a paradigm is. It's It's our experience. It's our habits, right? It's how we develop in life. I love crushing paradigms. It's my job to try to figure out how to change someone's way of thinking, because I do it to myself all the time, right? I have to step back. I have to step outside my comfort zone to try to see the opportunity outside of the comfort zone, right? The Navy SEALs have some great sayings as with regard to that. So here's the thing. I said to myself when I started in this space, I said, I want to do deals. I want to grow. I will do whatever it takes. I will go wherever I have to go. I will spend whatever money it takes, because it's the only way I'm going to grow in this space, because there's a lot of people in this space. I'm a beginner. There's no way years ago I was going to get anywhere unless I was willing to do anything and everything. So I got into a think tank, and within 2 weeks, I had someone reach out to thousands of people in this think tank and said, I need help. I'm like, I can help you. He's like, what can you do? I go, what do you need? Right? Well, I got this great deal. It's off market. I said, well, where is it? All of a sudden I'm flying across the country like a week later, and I'm on the ground and I'm saying, how about if I raise the money? I didn't know if I could raise all that money, but I said, if I say I'm going to raise it, I'm going to have to go figure out how to raise it. But what I ended up doing is bringing in some other partners, and we all raised it together. Right. And then that deal kind of fell apart. I ended up taking over the deal, putting the earnest money down, and it became my deal actually eventually. So here's my point. My point is, don't let those limiting beliefs, and specifically, don't let anyone outside of your circle of influence, even those that are in your circle of influence, influence you in a way that takes you away from your dreams. If your dreams are to retire early and take care of those grandkids, you must be 100,000% fixated on that goal and put systems and processes and people around you that are going to help you get to that goal quickly. And you're going to have to get very active, and you're going to have to avoid the naysayers. And believe me, you're going to achieve success. It's not a matter of if, it literally is a matter of when. And there are lots of things you can do to get you into that comfort zone by buying across the country and all this stuff. Don't look at those borders and miles and stuff as hindrance. It's not. It's actually better, because you won't be driving by the property 100 times a week, all freaked out and fixated because you see graffiti on the wall or something, right?
Yeah.
Finding the right property managers.
Yeah.
Always. Anyway,
when I started, I looked at, you know, I want to be able to get to places fairly quick, you know? And so when I started, I drew an 8-hour circle. I lived in DC at the time, drew an 8-hour circle. And it turns out that, you know, where my wife grew up was inside that 8-hour circle. And I did a lot of research on the markets, and a lot of it's just, you know, web searches, you know, and I found some websites that accumulated a lot of data on cities. And it was just like, okay, where are the cities that are growing? And I think that's a big thing, is where cities are growing. Now, once again, Chris talked about limiting beliefs. You know, I thought I had to be fairly close to the properties. You know, that was one of my limiting beliefs, but I had this 8-hour circle around it. But, you know, and we started investing in the Carolinas. You know, I was stationed in North Carolina for several years, so we were familiar with that area. And my wife grew up in South Carolina. So that's what got me looking into other states. You know, I immediately determined that DC and Baltimore weren't great places to invest for lots of reasons. But now I would expand it and say, you know, just definitely start talking to people, you know, see where other people are investing right now. And, you know, in a way you can follow the money, you know, I mean, a lot of money is being, you know, dumped into Texas real estate. A lot of money is being dumped in the Southeast. A lot of money is being dumped in the Phoenix real estate, you know, so you can follow the money. And then, like Chris said, I mean, don't look at distances, you know, look at, I would put it more into terms of time. You know, how long is it going to take me to get from my house to Dallas? You know, the answer is about 3 hours, you know, 20 minutes to drive to the airport, you know, 30 minutes to get on a plane, and, you know, 2.5-hour flight, you know, so I'm closer to Dallas than I am to my parents in Salt Lake City. You know, if you look at it in terms of time, you know, but if you look in terms of miles, Dallas is, you know, 10 times further away. But I think that follow the money for where, you know, a lot of the deals are. And, you know, don't be afraid to hop on a plane instead of a car.
There's a couple of things I've thought about. So you were talking about being able to raise money. When I retired from pharmaceuticals, I actually took a good chunk of my 401k that I had and put over into a self-directed IRA, strictly to be able to use for this, for real estate funding, whether it be either passive or buying apartment buildings or whatnot. Do you have a recommendation? I mean, as far as just passively investing it, or is that just go back to, okay, so how active do you really want to be?
Great question. For me personally, because I started very similar to you, I had some 401k money, I had some cash. I passively today invest in over 3,000 units across the country with multiple sponsors. It's not just me, because you can't generally, to avoid taxes and penalties, invest your own self-directed or EQRP in your own deals if you're a general partner. Generally, you do have to passively invest those in other people's deals. And a good way to learn is to passively invest with other people. We have several people, and I'm sure Brian can attest to this, that invest with us just to kind of learn. You know, they invest passively and they're like, hey, I kind of want to learn and you teach me a few things along the way. And then eventually they go off and do a 20 unit or 100 unit or whatever. So that is a good way to do it because at least you get to see the flow of the investor relations communication and things of that sort. If it's a good sponsor group, they might even teach you more than that, right? So that's definitely a good idea to at least get involved because if anything, you can share with the people you're trying to raise money from that you are actually invested in these deals and you can kind of explain the process to them. Whereas if you're not even invested in deals, you lose a little credibility there, right? At least in my opinion. And so now I invest in all my deals and I passively invest in other people's deals. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah. I'm a fan of passively investing in other people's deals as well. You know, you can see what other people are doing. You can see their, you know, so when we have investors, I mean, we're showing them webinars and we have, you know, our pitch decks that we send out to them for them to look over and decide whether they want to invest with us. But going through the process of passive investing, you know, if you're looking to raise capital, that puts you in an investor mindset, you know, where you're looking at a deal and saying, which one of these deals am I going to invest my money in? And I think there's a lot of benefit to having, you know, sorted through a bunch of deals and come upon a determination on where you're going to place your own money. Because if you're going out and looking for, you know, to raise private money from other people, you know, you've now been in their shoes. You know what they're thinking. You know what their considerations are. You know what they may be looking at or what may be detractors later on. So I think the process is very helpful. You know, I mean, some people would say, you know, should I invest in X or Y or Z or whatever? You know, I'll tell you what, you know, I can access my military 401k equivalent in about 2 weeks. And, you know, I'm going to be searching for deals to drop it into. You know, I'm putting it into my own self-directed plan. And I've got three or four that I'm looking at right now. And that's exactly what I'm going to be doing.
Okay. So those pretty well answer a lot of my, I guess, kind of financial questions. But so, Chris, when we go back to looking at apartment complex in Texas, and you were talking about you flying around, do you go in and look at these personally, or do you find, I guess, or whoever your boots are on the ground has the contractors, has the inspectors, has the agents, everybody to take a look at this stuff, and then you just come and look at it, the final deal, kind of like a final walkthrough type deal? How do you handle those kind of things as far as getting them to look at it and say, you know what, yes, I want to pursue this?
Sure. Well, thank you for the question, Robert. And there's different answers to that question. In my scenario, it's going to be different than perhaps your scenario or Brian's because of the radius of which you're looking at properties. But let's say it is across the country. I have different teams of people that are not just partners of mine, but even property management team members that have come along on several deals with us where they might send their due diligence team in. So I visit every property. It just depends on timing, which timing is what dictates that process, right? So I might be able to go in initially and check the property out before we go under LOI or even before we buy it. I might go in there once it's under purchase and sale agreement, or I might go in there during due diligence. It just depends. But I have team members that can go in as well. I have team members in New Jersey and in the Georgia area, right? And in Texas, I have team members in key markets we're in. So one of them could go in actually and do the inspections or the initial. We're all qualified to do it. We do a lot of video. A lot of drone videos so we can all see what's going on. And then obviously we have property management that we partner with that can go. So if you're close, it's going to be different. You're probably going to go. But if it's a long ways away, you're going to want to have those boots on the ground you're partners with, or even maybe a property management company that you've hired on a previous deal that could maybe help you out because they're already in the market. So there's different answers to that question, but don't feel like you have to do it all on your own. That's why you want to kind of try to bring a partner or two on if you can eventually.
Right.
Yeah, I'm going to say almost exactly the same thing. I don't go to every property. I've been to every property that we own, but you know, somebody from our team walks through the property before we put offers in, you know, just gets eyes on the property. And it's not a very detailed walkthrough because, you know, you're just looking at it. They don't allow you to go into every units, you know, when you're just doing a walkthrough like that. So, but somebody from our team is going to walk through the property, you know, usually before we put an offer in, not always, but usually before we put an offer in, somebody from the team is going to walk the property. And then when we do the due diligence, you know, every team member who's able to go out is going to go out. You know, sometimes that's me, sometimes that's not, you know, so, you know, just realize that, yes, somebody has to do it, but it doesn't have to be you. You know, it can be you. It just doesn't have to be you. You just have to, you know what you're good at and find partners who can do the rest. And I like Chris's model where he's got boots in the ground in key markets, you know, people who are living in those markets. And, you know, if he has something in one of those markets, it's a phone call. Hey, can you go check this out? Boom, done. Well, that said, we are about out of time. Thank you both so much for this conversation. It's been a great conversation today, and I appreciate it. Got one last question for each of you. And, you know, Chris, you get to go first. How can listeners learn more about you?
Wonderful. Well, again, Brian, thank you so much for having me. Tribe of Titans and Diary of a Podcast Investor. Love the stories. And Robert, thank you so much for taking the time and asking great questions. Please reach out if you ever need anything. You can find me at sterlingrhinocapital.com. Plain and simple. We've got a podcast starting and all kinds of other things. Love to interview you if you have a good story to tell. But sterlingrhinocapital.com, that's where you can find all about us.
All right. And Robert, same question for you. How can listeners learn more about you?
Well, right now I'm just on Facebook or email. So Robert Wade at Facebook, and then rwade_1 at charter.net email. So.
All right. And we will have links to, you know, Sterling Rhino Capital and then Robert's email address and his Facebook page in the show notes. So if you're interested in connecting with either of those two, you know, please do. That said, you know, once again, thanks guys for coming on the show. I really enjoyed my time here.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Diary of an Apartment Investor podcast today, brought to you by Four Oaks Capital. If you'd like to know more about how to invest in apartment buildings or want to be a guest in our show, visit our website at fouroakscapital.com/podcast or email us directly. If you're still listening, you obviously like the show, so pull out your phone, tap subscribe, and leave us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast app. And we'll see you again next week.